I mean, my main hope is that sharing my story helps someone else. And, you know, if you are like in the middle of a postnatal depression or any depression or anxiety right now, please get help, because there is help. And if you're struggling in parenting, I'm so happy for people to reach out. You know, they only get one childhood, you only get one motherhood or fatherhood while they're this age. So now's the time for action.
Are you a health professional wanting to explore all the options life has to offer? Then you've come to the right place. The Balanced Medics Handover podcast is all about living outside the box of what we've been told. I'm Isabella, your host, a junior doctor from Australia and trained coach. I'll be interviewing health professionals from all walks of life, artists, authors, non-clinical specialists, and more. These stories show that our choices are endless. Let's take the journey together. This is The Handover. Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Balanced Medics Handover podcast. This episode, we have Dr. Catherine Kizana on to share her story and journey through medicine. Catherine is an emergency medicine specialist who is also the founder of ABC Parenting, a service that empowers parents through education and coaching. Her business is based on lived experience, and I'm really grateful for Catherine to be here to speak about it and be so open about what her story is. Without further ado, let's hand over to Catherine. Hey, Catherine, how are you?
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you here. I first saw you speak at the Creative Careers Medicine Conference, and your speech really struck me because it was so open and vulnerable. So I'm really excited for you to be on here, and I think there's such power in sharing these stories. So do you mind starting with how you got to where you are now?
Sure. So I always feel like I have two versions of this story, because I have the version of what I thought was happening at the time and why I made certain decisions. And then I have the retrospectoscope and my, you know, years of sort of therapy and delving into why we do things. And so I sort of see it with that lens too. So I grew up in London to Irish migrant parents. So they moved to London from Ireland for my dad's job. He's a radiologist. And I was the third in my family. My two elder brothers were not particularly academic, and then I came along and I was. And so I was, as often happens in families, kind of labelled as the smart one.
Mm.
I loved school. I loved science. I loved learning. And so medicine always felt like a fairly natural path for me. I don't remember a time where I didn't want to be a doctor, other than when I wanted to own a like lolly shop, but my mum pointed out that I couldn't just eat them. I never felt I was forced into it. Obviously, my dad being a doctor, you know, it's sort of, I guess the path was there, but he certainly wasn't, he didn't even really encourage me. He just was a doctor, and I knew that. And yeah, I was, you know, good at school. I liked science. I liked the idea of helping people. So yeah, medicine just felt like a very natural choice. I always loved it. I loved medical school. I loved being a doctor. Of course, there were challenges and hard times, but I wasn't someone who didn't want to be there. And there were lots of people like that who were sort of forced into medicine. And I was always grateful that I didn't, you know, feel like that. I always say I loved medicine until I didn't. And it was quite a sudden change for me. So in England, you do essentially two intern years, that were foundation years back then. And so I did foundation year one and two in Birmingham, which is where I went to university. And then I have what I refer to as my quarter life crisis. So I was signed up for pediatric training. So in England at the time, they just had this big revolution in their training programs, and they wanted to create more equality between the jobs that were available at the end and the people they had coming in, essentially. So you were put on, a 5-6 year, whatever it was, training program for that specialty, and it was laid out for you, the kind of 6 years or whatever, and they only took in the number of people that they thought they needed at the top. That was the plan. I don't think it worked, but so I had this, so I got my pediatric training post, and I suddenly had this sort of 6 years laid out in front of me, and I just went, no. I also happened to break up with a long-term boyfriend at the time, and so I decided I was going to do what all good English doctors do. I was going to move to Australia for 9 months. 9 months, 16 years ago. And so I moved to Coogee, and yeah, I was just going to be here for a year and go back. So I managed to defer my training post. So the plan was come here for a year, have a bit of fun, go back and do my peds training. And yeah, that didn't happen. So when I came here, I worked at Westmead Hospital, and yeah, pediatrics turned into ED. So that's sort of
how Coogee to Westmead. Coogee to Westmead. That's a commute.
It was, but you know, I was like, I'm here for a year. I'm going to do it. I quickly, once I, you know, decided I was staying, I've slowly moved more west in my where I live. But yes, I did that a year, and it was great.
Yeah. So ED, you went from the UK to Australia, Westmead ED. Mm-hmm. What made you decide to stay in ED?
Yeah, again, so I have my answer at the time and my now, you know, what my therapist tells me. At the time I came, like I said, I always wanted to do pediatrics. I always loved kids, you know, that's just always what I wanted to do. And I'd just done an ED term back in the UK before I moved, and I'd enjoyed it. Okay, that's fine. You can enjoy that. Anyway, so when you come to Australia, that's often where they start you because you're the most supervised, you know, you don't know the system. And I was only 3 years out, so that's kind of where they start you off in the system. So I was in the emergency department, and a few things really drew me to staying. One was how different emergency medicine is here to the UK. I can't really speak to the UK now because I haven't worked there for 16 years, but then it was very 4-hour rule, move people through sort of. Whereas here, it was much more, you got to do a lot more. There was more, you know, trauma and kind of the fun stuff as I saw it then. I also had some incredible female consultants working in the department at the time who, you know, seemed to have it all. They were great at their job. They were mums. And I really felt like I found my tribe, essentially. I felt very at home there. I was good at it. You know, nurses were excited when I turned up for a shift, you know. And I think one of the biggest things was how much people wanted me to stay, and they were kind of encouraging me to train there, which is very different to my experience in the UK, which was there weren't enough training programs. You know, you had to kind of hustle to get in. Whereas here, I mean, they just needed people, right? So, and plus, I guess they liked me and I was good at it, and you know, so they were really, so I had people really encouraging me to stay, and that felt really nice. It's nice to be desired, isn't it? And to people to think you're good. So that's my reason at the time. My retrospective reason is that I was in chronic fight or flight mode. Everything was an emergency to me. And so I was very good at it. I could thrive in that environment, which is total chaos. I mean, we all know emergency departments, total chaos. I could, switch tasks. I could, you know, manage the macro as well as the micro of the patient. And I think my lifestyle at the time meant I could cope because I wasn't married. I didn't have children. I could just sleep on my days off. I slept when I was on night shift. You know, I could cope with it. Really, knowing what I know now, and when I tried to blend it with other things, it was a terrible environment for me. So we're essentially attracted to where we're comfortable. But sometimes that isn't what we need.
Yes. And then things change. So in your talk, you said you were a staff specialist by 30. Mm-hmm. And you were doing everything right, which I think a lot of listeners can relate to, because I think a lot of us might come from that kind of background. Of course, this is a generalization, but doing everything right, doing well in school, getting in young, doing a training program and getting it all done in one go. What was that like for you?
Yeah, so I think about this a lot. And if you give me, or before old me, if you gave me a list of, okay, you've got 4 years, this is what you need to do. You know, you need to do this rotation, you need to do a project, you need to do, I'm like, okay, bang, 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 off I go through that list. And it doesn't matter if I'm hating it, because I'm constantly looking at, okay, but that's the end point. Mm-hmm. And that whole idea of things will get better when. Things will get better when I'm a consultant. Things will get better when I get married, whatever it is that we all have in our head. And so I just plowed through. And if I can do something quicker, I want to do it. Like, I don't want to waste any time, even though, of course, it's not a waste of time to, you know, now I'm a big fan of meandering. Right? And the most interesting people you meet have meandered in their career, 100%. But at the time, meandering was a waste of time. Rest was a waste of time. There's a job to be done. And obviously, the quicker you get there, the better. That was just how I thought. Because I'd gone to medical school, it was undergraduate in the UK. So I was, you know, a doctor at 23. I'd done the 2 years in the UK, and then it was 4 years of training year plus a bit of a year when I wasn't in the training program yet. So essentially I was 30 when I got my fellowship. And then it really felt like falling off a cliff is the only way I can describe it. I think someone else talked about this at the conference, but you know, up to the point of getting a fellowship, you are in a support system. It's not, although hospitals have problems and, you know, none of it's ideal, but you still have a supervisor, you have someone that's looking at your training, you have a college, you have a framework even of, you know, you have to do this term and that term and this exam, and there's some kind of holding of that. Yeah. And then you get to the end and there's nothing. And I was still very young, you know, 30. And I just remember coming to work and this intern looking at me, and I thought, why is she looking at me like I look at people who know what they're doing? And I thought, oh, she thinks I know. I mean, of course she thinks I know what I'm doing, because I'm her consultant on shift. You know, I'm running the joint. And it was just this shock to me that, oh, suddenly I meant to kind of know. So it was very hard. And I think it was also, there'd been this whole build-up, hadn't there, of it's going to be okay when. And then I got there and I was like, oh, yeah, it's actually not okay. It also did coincide with, you know, and that was a timing, you know, just happened to coincide with getting married. And obviously then that shifts your sort of priorities potentially, and I suddenly had, you know, a husband that I obviously wanted to spend time with who wasn't doing shift work. He is a doctor, but he wasn't doing sort of regular weekends or night shifts or evening shifts, and so I suddenly really didn't want to be doing those things because I just wanted to kind of hang out with him. Then, you know, we went on a fertility journey, and that is all consuming, and so my priority shifted because of where I was in life, which happened to coincide with exiting any sort of support system and just feeling like, yeah, I was free falling.
Wow. And you touch on so many things there, like the arrival fallacy of, you know, you have this horizon ahead of you and this kind of idea that it'll get better then and get better then. And in medicine, like you said, you have this path laid out for you so far in advance. And there's almost a comfort in that, and, you know, the structure and knowing where you need to go and how to get there. And then not having that structure, it's a big shock, right? It's a big shock to be without that. And also I think that can be part of the issue with changing from medicine, you know, going without structure, maybe finding another alternative. And most of the world doesn't exist with that kind of 6-year laid out, this is what you need to do.
Absolutely. Yeah. There's some structure, definitely. But like anything, we find things comfortable because they, you know, bring us back to our comfort zone, which is created in childhood, essentially, psychologically. But it doesn't mean it's necessarily what's best for us.
Yes.
Necessarily.
Yeah. Exactly. It's the comfort zone, but not necessarily the right zone to be in. So your priorities changed. You got married. Fertility journey. I didn't know about this, so maybe you can share more on that if you're okay with that. So in the conference, your talk was really vulnerable about why you became a coach. Can you share more about what happened, you know, after becoming a parent and what happened then?
Yep. So, I mean, so the story starts a little bit before with the fertility, in that I only had 10 minutes to speak at the conference. I couldn't tell all my sob stories.
you have an hour to do it here. So
tell them all now. So look, essentially we weren't able to get pregnant naturally and needed to go down an IVF route, which, you know, for anyone who's done it, it's all consuming, physically, emotionally, it's time consuming, like you wouldn't believe, just with the physical stuff. Like it's, you know, blood tests every other day at certain stages in your cycle. It's surgery, you know, to do egg collections. It's and you know, the timing of it all is so intricate, on the ovulation. You know, you can't plan it a week in advance. So you're literally told, okay, say you've ovulated, we need to do this in 2 days' time. So I'm only letting work know 1 or 2 days in advance. I'm not coming for this morning shift, or I'm going to be an hour late to shift. You know, so it's stressful. And of course, you're not advertising to the whole world that you're going through this. You know, I did tell certain people. I told my boss at work, because A, he was lovely and supportive, and B, I just needed someone to know why I was, you know, going to be turning up late and stuff. I felt for me that was the right choice for me.
I just wanted to ask, how long was the process, like, because it's time consuming, how long did it take?
That's a good question, because I ended up having lots of surgery before even, you know, because obviously they're looking for causes. So, you know, I had some endometriosis, so I had surgery to kind of look at that, sort that out, and then it was sort of a budding onto my bowel, so I had to have a colonoscopy to see if it had gone through. So, you know, there was months of that before even kind of getting to the point of, you know, daily injections to stimulate eggs and whatnot. And then we had several sort of failed rounds, so yeah, I'd say probably a year or more, even from sort of first consult to having a baby, you know, getting pregnant. So it was very time consuming, very stressful. It's, you know, and our job isn't one where you just go and, you know, sit in an office and you can take care of yourself. You know, I was seeing people pregnant who didn't want to be. I was seeing people who'd had their babies taken away. I was seeing, you know, you see this whole spectrum, and obviously everyone's going through their own journey. It's not about judgment, but it's very hard when that's all you want, right? You're just consumed by that desire. And of course, you're going to get people asking you, don't you?
Oh, yeah. You know, when are you getting pregnant?
I started
like, I'm out. Trying.
Yeah, well, you can really shut people down if you want. But anyway. So that was kind of, you know, the lead up to even getting pregnant. And I'd actually gone part time then to try and sort of cope with all of that, really to just have less, feel like I was letting the team down less by turning up late and sort of things. So although it still managed to always be on the day when I was working. I don't know why.
Of course.
So I was already part-time, and then you think about, you know, even physically I'd had, I don't know, 5 surgeries in that time. So, you know, 5 anesthetics, 5 traumas to my body, you know, God knows, hormones and, you know, all that. Like, it's very physically, it's a lot. and then, you know, then mind the emotions. And then, yeah, so we get pregnant. My pregnancy was awful. I've never felt so physically unwell for so long as I did. I vomited every day up to 20 weeks and then started again at the end. I felt really low. Looking back, I think I probably had some depression during the pregnancy, but I just thought it was kind of physical and I felt unwell. And I did a lot of sleeping, lying around, couldn't work for basically my first trimester. Went back to work at sort of 14 weeks, fainted in the department on the first day back, you know, was off for another few weeks. Like, it was just, yeah. So by the time I actually had the baby, you know, that was kind of the lead up to it all.
Yeah.
But then I actually felt quite good. Physically, I felt better because, you know, she was out and, you know, hormones settled and whatever, and I wasn't nauseous. And I remember thinking I was in trouble because the hospital food tasted great. And I thought, well, that just shows how unwell you've been. Because I'm sure the hospital food wasn't actually that good, but I was so happy to not be nauseous. Yeah, so we actually did really good for the first few months, which is when a lot of people struggle. You know, I didn't have problems initially. You know, breastfeeding was tricky and the usual things, and, you know, big changes to life, but we were doing okay until she hit 3 months. So 3 months was the beginning of the decline. And, you know, I was sitting there holding her and I noticed blood on my leg. And my first thought was, oh my God, is it the baby? Is it me? Have I cut myself? Of course, it was period returning, wasn't it? But it kind of didn't occur to me that that's what it was. And this all coincided with her sleep regression. So that 4 month sleep regression. So at 4 months, the baby's sleep cycles change and they actually become like adult sleep cycles. So they get 45 minute sleep cycles. So they can often then wake every 45 minutes or every 2 hours and need resettling and whatnot. So yeah, she was waking every 2 hours. My hormones were back on the roller coaster. And yeah, I just kind of plummeted very fast, very, very fast, within a month, anxiety was the main symptom. That kind of led to a depression then, because I mean, they often go hand in hand, but yeah, it was an anxiety. It was just pure panic. And I think I said in the talk, there wasn't anything I was anxious about specifically. You know, people thought maybe I was worried about the baby physically because I'd seen all this trauma in ED. I'm like, nope, that wasn't it. Like, there wasn't anything tangible to sort of grip onto. The only words I had were, but what if I can't cope? And, you know, my husband was, you know, baffled by this because he's like, but you are coping, and what sort of, yeah, what do you mean? I was like, I don't know. It was just this fear that she was so dependent on me, obviously, appropriately. And what if I couldn't do it? Because there's no break, is there? There's no, yeah, it's just sort of it's such an important role. I don't know. Yeah. I still find it hard to explain, but it was just pure terror. And I was begging him not to go to work, which was not sustainable. And it really came to a head. He had a weekend on call and he used to do long procedures on a Friday. And he kind of never knew when they were going to end. So they could be 2 hours, they could be 8 hours. And anyone that has a young baby at home, you know, like when your partner walks in the door, like that's kind of the end of your marathon, right? That's sort of the finish line. And not knowing when that finish line was coming on this particular day, and knowing that I had to also cope the whole weekend because he was going to work, that was just all too much. And yeah, we had to escalate things then. So he ended up having to cancel his weekend. He got a fully cover, and we saw a psychiatrist on that Friday. So the earliest appointment we can make. I don't know how much you want to go into this, but it's fascinating that the psychiatrist's conclusion at the end of our session was that, you know, I was very attached to my baby. She told me that. And she didn't think I needed medication. And, you know, to kind of crack on, essentially. And by the Monday, I was in a psychiatric unit. And nothing external happened in that weekend. It's not like, you know, I didn't sort of attempt suicide or nothing kind of triggered it. So we often reflect on that, husband and I, how doctors struggle to manage other doctors as patients.
Yeah.
And, you know, we went in there very clear that I was struggling. I wasn't, you know, putting on a brave face. I wasn't, you know, trying to appear competent. It's just that we are very competent people. So I did appear sort of competent and I didn't lose the bond with Mia. So I was still breastfeeding her. So I was, you know, breastfeeding her in the session, but telling her how much I was struggling. But for whatever reason, to do with herself, maybe she, I don't know. I still don't know the answer. But she didn't think I was that unwell, which was very, very hard because I went there obviously wanting help. And to be told I was okay when I clearly wasn't okay was, very.
Yeah. Do you think there was an element of fear about, you know, mandatory reporting or what to do with that?
So I always find this very interesting because this is a big fear doctors have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a lot of it is unfounded in the sense that, you know, you have to be, you know, having depression or anxiety or an addiction per se is not reportable.
That's right.
If it's affecting your patient care. Now, at the time, I obviously wasn't working. I was on maternity leave, so I wasn't affecting anyone's patient care. And the fact is I was getting treated, so it wasn't going to affect patient care. So I find it's the irony of if you go and get help, you're not going to affect patient care.
Yes.
But people don't get the help because there's this big fear. And I don't know where this fear comes from, if someone has been reported when they shouldn't have. I don't know what started it, but it's interesting because she actually said to me I was being admitted and it was all done over the phone, and she said to me, look, and don't worry about this from in terms of your registration, you know, you're a voluntary patient, there's nothing
right.
to report, essentially. And I remember at the time thinking, wasn't even on my radar, right? Like, and I understand why it would be, and maybe it should have been, but I was so unwell,
that was the last thing on your mind
I was thinking about. But I mean, great that she, you know, addressed it. But yeah, so I often try and reassure people. Like, I spent 4 weeks as a psychiatric inpatient and no one has reported me, rightly so, because I didn't affect patient care.
Yes.
And
voluntary, which is good because it was, you know, you got the help you needed before it got to the point where it needed to be beyond that.
Sure. But I think even if I'd become psychotic, and been involuntary admitted, I still don't think it would have been, wouldn't have been an issue for patient care at the time because I was not, you know, with patients. And I think, you know, you recover and get treatment. And so, yeah. But anyway, I understand it's a big fear for people, but, I like to tell my story as a way of maybe helping to alleviate some of that fear.
Yeah, it's important, I think, to talk about that because there is sometimes that misunderstanding. And even as a doctor who treats another doctor, thinking, do I need to report in this scenario? Mm. And just educating when you do and don't, because the threshold is high.
Yeah.
Plus
a report doesn't mean you're going to be struck off, right? Even if it did
yes.
get to that point. So.
Yeah. Yeah, I've written about this. I forgot the exact stats, but it's like less than 5% of people go beyond a certain thing. Like, usually it's just they investigate and nothing actually happens most of the time. That's the most common thing. I wanted to ask you, in hindsight, because I know you said when you became a consultant, you felt like you were free-falling. And then after giving birth, you had that panic. Do you feel like that whole period between becoming consultant to giving birth was a one big free fall?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, I think, and you know, it's like anything, there's never just one, you know, thread that unravels. It's all intertwined, isn't it? And, you know, had I gone through infertility and a pregnancy as a registrar, would it have been any different? No, I think I probably still would have had postnatal depression. It might have even been worse because the whole pressure of training, I don't know. So I don't think it's as, yeah, it's that's a difficult question. I think it all, you know, it all adds up. And I think it, you know, it goes back my whole life. My whole life adds up to that moment in small ways, right? And, you know, I mean, this is, you know, I'm happy to tell this bit of the story, but in the hospital, they had psychology sessions, and one of them was about looking at your own response to your own emotions and why you have that response. So it was the circle activity. So you drew a circle, and inside the circle, you wrote down the name of the emotions that were accepted in your home growing up, and outside the circle, you wrote down the emotions that weren't accepted, whether that be obvious, like, how dare you be jealous of your brother, or we don't say hate in this family, or something. Or it was just more subtle and you kind of knew, you know, what to do to get accepted, like a lot of us do. And yeah, everyone in the room drew the same circle, and that was my moment of, okay, well, how we were parented matters. And yeah, that's obviously been a big part of where I've gone next. But even for me at the time, it's that idea that it's not one thing that gets you to breaking point, right? It's a thousand things. It's like with burnout, it's not the one dramatic, usually, it's not the one dramatic patient event that, you know, went wrong and it all horrible. It's all the small moments where you take on patient's pain and, you know, trauma, and it doesn't go anywhere. You don't have a system for processing it. So it's all the small things that build up.
Yeah.
So I essentially didn't have good emotional intelligence. There was shame attached to feeling certain ways. So when I did feel anxious, I then a whole load of shame came on top, and I was actually anxious about being anxious, which is a crazy cycle to be in. But this was the start of understanding why. You know, and my parents, God love them, summed it up beautifully, because I had to ring them. So they're still in England. So I had to ring them and I debated. I mean, this tells you, I actually debated whether to tell them I'd been admitted or not, because I always want to protect them and their feelings. So they're not, no, that's not fair to everyone. So I rang and I said, I've been admitted to psych hospital. Big shock for them, because they see me as very competent and put together. And my dad said, I hope you're holding your own in there. And it's well-meaning, look, you know, but it's just like, no, I'm not holding my own. That is my point.
That's like, why I'm here.
It's literally the definition of not holding your own. And my mum's response was, oh, well, is there someone who can take Mia, my daughter, my baby at the time, out for walks at least so she can get out? And I was like, yes, I can. I'm not strapped to a padded cell. Like, you know, so the concern was for the baby.
Yes.
Not this baby. And again, like, my parents, you know, they love me and they did their best, but it was a big moment of, yeah, like, you really just, they just don't have capacity to hold these sorts of themes. Question now, but yeah, that's
yeah. And it leads me on to what I wanted to ask you though, like, what drew you to becoming a parenting coach, to ABC Parenting?
Yeah, so I mean, this was the beginning of it. So this idea that the way we are parented impacts us. And I think there's this myth that we all have, and the older we get, we think, oh, my childhood isn't affecting me. It was 40 years ago. And I'm here to tell you all, your childhood was not 40 years ago. Your childhood lives inside you. It literally formed the neural circuits of your brain. It, you know, through attachment theory, we know that the attachment we form with our primary caregiver in the first 2 years of life dictates, gives us the blueprint for how we expect relationships to go in life. So if you have a secure attachment as a child, you go through life like, yep, sure, bad things are going to happen. I can reach for help when I need it and I'll get help. And I'm, you know, stable in who I am and I'm all good. If you have an insecure attachment, which, you know, 40 to 60% of us do, myself included, you don't have that secure base. And so, yeah, there's just ongoing effects. It's like the pebble and then the ripple. And you also, you know, probably have an ongoing relationship with your parents, you know, unless they've passed. And even then, they're in your head, right? So this idea that childhood is a thing of the past and doesn't need to be looked at and, you know, doesn't need to be processed is false, in my opinion. And this was really the beginning of learning that for me. And then, of course, then I'm like, well, how can I do this differently then so that I don't, you know, Mia isn't a psych patient when she's 40. Yeah. or if she is, I won't be saying, are you holding your own in there? And of course, without a blueprint to do it, without we all just parent the way we were parented, you know, and I'm sure everyone listening has had that moment where their mother has come out of their mouth, right? The exact phrase that your mum said, even though you swore you would never say it. And that's just that psychology. It's how we're programmed. We just, default to those patterns. And so I knew to break that, I was going to need some help. So it's therapy. It was going through parent coaching myself. And at the time, so work-wise, I obviously recovered from my postnatal depression, went home. My mat leave was due to come up at the end of the year. So I had a year planned anyway, and I really just didn't want to go back, and I kept extending it. And then eventually made the decision that I can't physically go back to an emergency department and be the type of doctor I want to be and the type of mother I want to be. Despite, I think, emergency medicine being pretty good in terms of specialties for part-time work, you know, because you can turn up, do your shift, and patients are all new, hopefully, if you've got flow in your hospital. But it was the 10 hours for me. I just, it was too much. So then I did some telehealth, and which was great. And I actually kind of worked my way up that company to be deputy chief medical advisor there, and was really enjoying that. So I was doing 2 days a week of that. But once I kind of decided I wasn't going back to the physical emergency department, the feeling there was, well, I can't continue that job then because I need to be doing both, which I'm not sure I agreed with that decision. But anyway, that was the decision. So I had to essentially leave that job. And then I had about, well, I didn't know, but looking back, I had about 6 months of not doing anything in the sense of work. But I needed that time. And I think I'm lucky that my husband understands that. Sometimes you just need to be doing nothing to actually allow the space for the thoughts and the, you know.
Yeah. And, and it's not just nothing. It's you know, actively resting, right? Recovering. Yeah,
exactly. And, you know, I still had a 1.5, well, what was she then? She was probably 3. You know, so I
started, that's more than nothing for sure.
Yeah. So I started doing all that. And and just thinking and journaling and, you know, just thinking about what I wanted to do. And I kept coming back to, it's actually a person I follow on Instagram, Alita Blanchard is her name. She's a parent coach. And I love how she puts stuff. I love that she shares her own vulnerability in a helpful way, like, you know, this happened with my kids today, I yelled, but this is what I'm going to do, you know, just sort of very real. And I kept coming back to, I want to be her when I grow up. So then my friend was like, just message her, you know, she's like a real person. I was like, oh. So I did, and she of course was lovely and told me how she became who she is and where she trained. And so I did that. So I trained with the Jai Institute of Parenting. It's a, you know, 9-month program. So that's sort of where I ended up. And I wanted to, you know, I had this, I actually have a list. I still have it because I wrote, and I recommend this to anyone who's struggling with their career, just write on a piece of paper my ideal job. Now, don't think about what your ideal job is in terms of a job title or whether it exists or not. Just write down what the components of your ideal job are or what bits of you want it to use. So mine said, like, you know, work from home, control over my environment, flexible hours, using communication skills, helping people, you know, like sort of quite vague, but the real stuff, right? And that's where, and of course, that is exactly what I'm doing. But you don't, I think if you get caught up in, does the job exist?
Yes.
You know, I mean, I wrote work from home as an emergency physician. I mean, that pre-pandemic, pre, you know, this whole telehealth kind of rise, was just a stupid thing to write down, wasn't it? Like, I mean, well, it was just, as in, you know, it felt silly. It felt
yes.
Silly. But the important thing is to just write it down, just to get it out there. And then you start, once you know what you're really looking for, it's amazing, then your brain starts looking for it. Right? And we know that this is how our reticular activating system works. If you want to buy a Toyota, you see Toyotas everywhere. If you want to get pregnant, you see pregnant people everywhere. You know, we literally filter the information coming through. You've got to kind of know what you're sending your brain out to look for.
Yeah, and it's permission to dream, permission to think about what else could be. And in my own coaching, you know, you can get to, if you focus on the how in the beginning, it can be very, it can really stop you in your tracks.
Yeah.
But if you just explore the, you know, what do I enjoy? What is here? It can really start to open things up for you. And then the how becomes clear at the end somehow. It just kind of opens up at the end.
And it's hard to explain. And at the time I was like, I don't know what I'm doing here, writing this down. But anyway.
Yes.
It works.
Yeah, it worked. Here you are. You're doing ABC parenting. I wanted to see if you've seen any recurring themes in the work you do, you know, as a parent.
Oh, yes, I have. I would say the big one is fear. If I had a magic wand and I could magic away something in the world of parenting to make it everything easier for everyone, it would be fear. There is the theory that there are only two motivators for action, and it's fear and love at the core. And a lot of what we do as parents, unfortunately, is coming from a place of fear. And this is not a judgment on people, obviously, but, you know, it's a fear of something in the future which takes you away from what's happening now. And the example I always use is, you know, myself. And when Mia was 6 months old, she had peanut butter for the first time. She got this, like, full-on, like, urticarial rash. And I kid you not, my first thought, not anaphylaxis, not no emergency physician, like, actually something useful. Two thoughts. One, she's never going to be able to eat Thai food. She's 6 months old now, bear in mind. And two, he's going to be the kid that no one wants in the sleepover. Now, those are crazy things to think, right? But you would be amazed, and I encourage, again, everyone to reflect on what your actual thoughts are, because when we know what the fear is, then we can deal with it. You know, and the problem is that when we're, you know, when I'm off in my head, oh, no one's going to have a sleepover, I'm not dealing with the now. I wasn't comforting her. I wasn't getting an antihistamine, you know, like doing anything kind of useful. So that's the theme I see all the time. Like, oh, my kid's clinging to my leg at drop off. And you say, what's the fear? And of course you have to get to that, right? People don't just know what their fear is, but it's usually something like they're not going to have any friends, or I've made them too attached by breastfeeding them, or it's just, and it's often this, we kind of create problems now because we're trying to deal with a potential problem in the future. And a lot of the time it's unnecessary pain, like, you know, because children grow and develop, so that won't be a problem when they're 10. You know, they're not going to sleep in your bed till they're 16. It's just not going to happen. So a lot of fear and a lot of, we're reacting to our own childhoods. And people, you know, don't know that. You know, that's a common thing people say to me is, I had not made that connection. I had no idea. And I'm like, of course you hadn't. I mean, none of us, no one does until you do, you know, until you need to, until you go through this process. Not many people will make the connection.
Yeah. And you can normalize, right? And be like, that's how everyone's childhood was, or something like that, and then you might need an outside view to be like, actually, not really.
Yes, we have a huge defense mechanism set up around our own childhood, and what the way I like to talk to clients is, you've got two things can be true. So you can look back at your childhood with your adult brain and say, oh, of course, you know, my parents were migrants and dad got sick and they you know, they had to move, and of course they were stressed, and you know, all the things, right? All the reasons. And that's all true, and your parents did the best they could. And you were a child and you were impacted by that in whatever way. And both are true, and both can be held, and both need space, because when we're so busy defending with our adult brain, we ignore little us, who didn't have an adult brain back then, right? And it still impacted us. Or if we go the other way and we're too, you know, blame, and this is my experience of what happened, and not, you know, not sort of thinking about our parents as whole people. So it's kind of holding both, both to be true. So yeah, the fear, and then this idea about emotional regulation. This is a huge thing. Everyone wants their kids to be emotionally regulated, but I don't think people know what that is. You know, I had a boss tell me once, you know, for someone who claims to have emotional intelligence, you're very emotional. And I was like, well, firstly, I've never claimed to have emotional intelligence. Thank you. Thank you for seeing me like that. And two, that doesn't mean you don't have emotions. This is the big myth, right? That you're emotionally regulated if you just don't have your emotions.
Yeah.
Emotional regulation to me is three steps. It's one, I'm aware of my physical sensations. So I can feel my heart rate coming up. I feel myself getting hot, whatever it is in your body. Two, then you label that as an emotion. So, okay, this is me getting angry. So now three, I need to do something with that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you've got your external assistance, like I'm going to go hit a pillow or whatever you do, or you've got your, sorry, that's your internal. And then your external is, I need help. So I'm going to go and your kid's going to tell mummy, I'm feeling angry. I don't know what to do, or whatever it is. So it's, you know, it's those three steps. So it's the regulation part is regulating your behavior, not squashing the emotion. Because squashing the emotion just means it comes firing out somewhere else.
Yeah.
So we actually don't feel our feelings. And I, for years, thought my feelings. I could tell you maybe what I was feeling, and I could tell you why sometimes, but I wasn't feeling it. I wasn't connected to it in my body. So this is what I have to take parents through. And unfortunately, most of the time, the parents don't have the emotional regulation that they're expecting their five-year-old to have, but they don't have it. So like if you yell or you lose it and you scream, like we do, I did it yesterday, that is us losing our emotional regulation in that moment. Yet we have no capacity to sympathize with our children when they do it, when they have developing brains, when they don't have a prefrontal cortex yet, like all these things. So, and it really comes down to how that parent's emotions were managed as a child. And yeah, so it's again drawing that sort of connection.
Yeah.
Fear and this emotions just wanting to squish. I want to squash the tantrum. I want to, everything's just like, I want to just squish that down. And actually, what we want to do is let it out.
Yeah, that kind of everything's fine, you know, that serene visual. What would you say to the parent listening who is feeling the overwhelm?
Yeah. I'd say, I see you. You make sense. I think this is the biggest thing that parent coaching gave me is an understanding of why we feel the way we do, why we react the way we do. You know, the polyvagal theory of you know, nervous system regulation. So we've got time or... You want to go into this too much, but like you got your green zone, that's your sort of ventral vagal play, you know, your sort of social engagement. Then we've got our red, which is our fight or flight. So we've started to sense danger. That's our sympathetic nervous system coming in, right? So we're now, you know, kidding, yelling, screaming, whatever we're doing. And then we've got our blue, which is really kind of an immobilization shutdown. When you're in that red zone, either for too long, which is the current thing, like we get chronic fight or flight and we just go into shutdown, or you're really in a life-threatening situation, so you know, the animal that's cornered will go play dead, that sort of thing. And knowing all of that and where you are in that zone and how and where your kids are just makes so much sense. So you know, I put on my socials yesterday about I lost it at my kid last night first time. But I make sense because I'm, you know, I didn't sleep well, I'm premenstrual, there's a lot going on at work and home for other people, you know, there's a lot going on basically, and she was resisting sleep and I flipped into my red zone essentially, And the key is that now I don't kind of fall into a shame spiral of I'm a terrible person, you know, I've broken her and all those things, because I understand this framework and because I know how to repair and you know, get myself regulated again, I guess. So your question is, what would I say to the parent? I think what I would love to say to people is that help is available. I think people don't think that therapy or coaching or whatever is going to work because I can't change the fact that I have three kids and a full-time job and a husband who's a surgeon, whatever, right? So you think, oh, I can't change any of that, so there's no point getting help. But just there is, because it's how we perceive things that causes us a lot of our nervous system dysregulation and our reactions to things. And, you know, this is why I talk about empowering parents. So I want to empower you with science. So the attachment science, that's key to understanding yourself and your kids and why they act in certain ways, the nervous system, you know, brain development, all this scientific stuff, and the support, because you can't have one doesn't work without the other, really, to get real transformation. And so the support is kind of integrating it. So, yeah, I would say, yeah, you make sense. You know, I see you, I am you. But there is help, and there is so much that can change without anything external happening, without anything external changing. You don't have to leave your partner and give up a couple of kids and, you know.
Yeah.
Like, big change can happen.
Yeah, internally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which then has an amazing ripple effect on everyone in your family.
Oh yeah, and all aspects of your life, right? Beyond family, even. What would you say to your intern self?
It's interesting because I wouldn't change anything in my journey because it all led me to that breaking point, which, although horrible at the time, just needed to happen. And I don't think, you know, sometimes I think, oh, if I got into therapy earlier, would I, you know, not have done XYZ? Would I maybe have been able to stay in the UK and be near my family, you know, and all these things? But then, you know, I wouldn't have met my husband and I wouldn't have my child. So, yeah, I think I would just say, keep going. You're exactly where you're meant to be. And I'm not sure I would have. I loved being. I mean, obviously there was, you know, there was stress associated with it, but yeah, I was quite happy as an intern.
Yeah. Keep going.
Keep going. Yeah. Just to take the next right steps and you end up somewhere good.
Yeah. Trust that it's all going to be ending up okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's a question that you would like me to ask you right now?
You just nailed all your questions, Isabella. So. I don't know. I think we covered the thing about coaching. I think, you know, this idea that people, they don't get how coaching can help. And, you know, I have clients who, like, I mean, I'll give you maybe a couple of examples from my coaching. So I have a client who's a doctor. They're both doctors, the parents. And they've got a 7-year-old with very big emotions, and it comes out as hitting and yelling, and they were really, really struggling, and just a real sense of helplessness about how to manage this. And after our third session, her grandmother died, and she had to travel overseas to see her grandmother and take the child with her, which would have been undoable, really, 3 weeks prior because of behaviours, and she would have been. And so when we checked in afterwards, she just said it had gone amazing. And I said, oh, what do you think allowed it to go so well? And she said, oh, just shifting my perspective about what his behavior means and shifting my perspective to actually my job here is still him. And he doesn't know the significance of this. He can't be expected to just suddenly, but, you know, develop a prefrontal cortex because he's at a funeral. Like, it's just not going to happen. So she just went in with really clear expectations and had the right support for herself. And yeah, just when we see behavior as connection seeking rather than attention seeking, and you know, we'd unpacked a lot of stuff by then, but just 3 sessions in, it just blew me away that, you know, for quite a short period of time, I mean, she'd done the work and committed to it and stuff, but yeah, just such a big change, and without him needing really to change much. But of course he did change because she changed, so yeah, this low effect. And I've had, you know, clients with teenagers, because people think, oh, it's too late to do anything when I've got a teenager, because, you know, they're just grumpy, you know, and they had a teenager who just spent all her time in her room and just eye rolled every, you know, every time they spoke, and they were having all these big issues. And yeah, a few sessions in, she was just sitting at the table reading instead of being in her room. Like, it just slowly the kids started coming back out, and they were blown away because they're like, she doesn't know we're doing coaching, we've not spoken to her about what we're doing. So just them getting less triggered by her, they were just less reactive to, you know, you unpack, what does that eye roll mean to you, you know? And this, when I was talking about the nervous system regulation earlier, the important thing is that we know that we go into a sympathetic response when we feel danger, right? So I know now if a masked man came into the room, I'm going to go into fight or flight. But I also go into fight or flight when my child says, I hate you, you're the worst mum ever. And I also go into fight or flight when she gives me that, you know, when she's 3 and she's like, no, you know. So things that in our own childhood were met with, you know, shame, or you were hit, or you were disconnected from your primary caregivers, because when you're a child, that's life-threatening, okay, to be disconnected, to be sent to timeout, all those things. So if that happened to you as a child, your nervous system has registered SAS is dangerous. Talking back is dangerous. Having big emotions is dangerous. Anger is dangerous. So when you experience those now, or you experience them in your child, you flip into the danger mode. So it's learning, like, what, yeah, we have this idea that oh, I'm safe. But you don't feel it. It's this felt.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's huge. The feeling it, in my own experience as a coach as well, that you can theoretically, I think, you know, we're all quite capable people. Theoretically, you know, a lot of things, right? Theoretically, you know, this is how you take care of yourself and be well and all that kind of stuff. But do you physically feel it, right? Because you can't lie to how your body physically feels, or you can't explain it away.
Yeah. And that, you know, this whole wellness, and, you know, there's a lot of work at this at the moment. I think it's fabulous. But the big thing, the big question to me is, you have to get to the block. What is the block in someone taking care of themselves?
Yes.
And it's a there will be a psychological block on some level. You know, it either wasn't modeled to them, they grew up with a sense that their needs weren't as important as other people. Like, a lot of people that went into medicine have that as their childhood story.
That self-sacrificing behavior, yeah.
So, you know, I think, like, all that work is great, but there's also this, I mean, look, I think all doctors, all med students should get therapy. That would be, if I had another magic wand. I think if you work out why you end up in medicine, and again, it's not that you need to change that, or that you necessarily shouldn't be in medicine, but just understanding yourself and your potential lack of boundaries means you can then change that and work towards, you know, building those up.
Yeah, that's the beauty. Yeah, and I just want to say that's the beauty, is that, yes, your childhood happened. Yes, those were the cards you were dealt. But now it's also about, how is it affecting you now, and how can you change things now for the future? Like, you can.
Yeah,
change things, and that's the beauty of it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, I know I'm aware of the time. Are you okay for the final few questions? Do you have any? Okay, cool. So I ask this of everyone. Some people love this question, some people hate it. What is balance to you?
Yeah, so I think balance is internal. It's an internal sense of I'm okay. And it's kind of riding the waves, because the waves are going to come. And it's, you know, to me, it all comes back to this attachment idea. So if you have a secure attachment with yourself, which is what I help clients build, because most of the people coming, obviously seeking parent coaching, turn out not to have a secure attachment themselves. So it's building that within yourself so that you see yourself you can parent yourself. You give yourself what you weren't given, right, as a child. So you see yourself for who you are. You love all those parts of yourself. So then when the waves come, you're sort of more centered and stable. And I think only from that you can kind of create this balance in your life, because there is no having it all. That is BS, right? You can have a little bit of lots of things, but you can't. Yeah, you just can't do it all. There's time limits and there's energy limits. And I think just accepting that you are you. So I know there are people who can work 10-hour shifts and be incredible mothers, right? I know that. I know them, and you know, kudos. I can't. And that's okay. And it's accepting what your version of a work-life balance or whatever, you know, balance, whatever else you're trying to balance, it's your version of that. And it's where your nervous system is set, and it's, yeah, what your needs are. So I think it has to be internal first.
Yeah. And what came to my mind when you're saying that is accepting that we're human, right? That we have limited energy every day, and we have needs. And I think what you're saying about, you know, 10 hours and parenting, for some people it's just, maybe it's great for them, for others maybe not, but you know, we're all human and we have the needs we have, and we are who we are.
And I was 30, Isabella, before I accepted that I had needs, because up to that point, needs just in my brain went straight to too needy. That was the path that was in my brain. So yeah, this idea that I had needs and it was okay to ask for those to be met, or you know, take steps for those to be met, just was not a framework I had.
Yeah, and I think if you see the pattern, at least even in junior doctors, the physical need to eat, to drink water, to pee.
Yeah.
it's at the very basic level, it's shut off. And I think, you know, I got so good at holding my bladder that the only thing that made me realize I needed to pee at one point was pain in my back. And I'm like, okay, I think I'm holding my bladder a bit too long. Yeah. I'm like, that's a bit too long.
Yeah.
So it's amazing how far we can push ourselves, but we don't necessarily need to do that.
It comes at a cost,
100%. Yeah. Is there anything else you'd like to add that you think would benefit the listeners?
No, I hope I've made sense. I hope there's some context there, which obviously I can only touch on. But yeah, my main hope is that sharing my story helps someone else. And, you know, if you are like in the middle of a postnatal depression or any depression or anxiety right now, please get help, because there is help. And if you're struggling in parenting, I'm so happy for people to reach out. You know, they only get one childhood. You only get one motherhood or fatherhood while they're this age. So, now's the time for action.
Yeah. Yeah, there's help. I'll put some links in the show notes for resources. I think sharing your story is so powerful. And also just letting people know they're not alone, that it's more common than we all think, a lot of these struggles.
Yeah.
How can people reach out to you, get parenting coaching if they'd like that?
Yeah. So my business is ABC Parenting. So that to help people remember, that is because I'm an emergency physician, and obviously the ABC of airway, breathing, circulation always kept me calm in a big trauma situation. It sort of unites the team. And I wanted to give a similar framework for parents. So it's A for attachment, B for brain development and nervous system regulation, and C for curiosity. So it's ABC Parenting, and it's, you know, if you work with me, you learn all those sort of tools and framework to see things through. And it just means in any situation, you're like, hang on, wait a minute, ABC, okay, this is what I need to do. And it's, you know, I don't want to help you with your two-year-old. I want to help you with your two-year-old up to when they're 40, because my mother tells me I'm 42 and still annoying her. So, you know, you're there forever.
Children are for life.
Exactly, like puppies. So it's, you know, my website's abcparenting.com.au. My Instagram is abcparentingcoach. And I share a lot of my own parenting on there and things to try and just keep it real and, yeah, just give people information and try and help people not feel alone, I guess. But yeah, you can reach out there.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and thank you for – I was going to ask you about the name, so thank you for bringing that up. And I really like that there is – I'm like, is it ABC, like the just the alphabet? But I love that it's that structured approach that you're right. It gives you a lot of comfort in crisis situations, right? Because your bandwidth is a certain amount and you're like, okay, what do I know?
It gives you a framework and it, you know, it calms you down, which then calms them down. And yeah, and it's really kind of like a solid foundation to, and it's all, you know, science-based. And, you know.
Yes. Yeah. I'm glad that you brought in the science today. Thanks for that. I think a lot of listeners will appreciate the science and the evidence, right? Thank you again for coming on. It's been so great to chat and hear your story.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Balance Medics Handover Podcast. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, I'd love for you to take a minute to rate and review this podcast and click the follow button. For more resources, check out the Balance Medics website. The link to this will be in the show notes below. See you next episode.